Okay, it's a pleasure to welcome everyone to this evening's class. I'll just say by way of introduction, I had to restrain myself. I think every Purim class this year is called From Haman to Hamas, colon, and then the name of the class. I tried to come up with something which would be a little different from everything else that's circulating, as important as that topic continues to be. So what I'd like to do this evening is unpack with you what I consider to be the chapter of the Megillah, which on its face is actually the least important. Okay. And what I want to try to identify with you is really what this chapter is about and what its purpose is, what it's doing here. So, if you have the text in front of you, I just want to run through it quickly to remind everyone of what's happening in this chapter. Even though one of the advantages of learning Megillas Esther is we really know the story quite well. Okay, so just to refresh your memory, chapter 5 is the first banquet. Chapter 7 is the second banquet. So chapter 6 is this story in between what's about to be the kind of denouement of the story. So let's just jump right in and remind ourselves what's happening in this chapter. I'm going to share it on the screen with you if I can figure out how to do that. All right, so it should be shareable in a moment. All right, so you should have with you in front of you the sixth chapter. It starts this way. The king couldn't sleep. We have to wonder why that is. And he asks for the Book of Chronicles to be read to him. And they discover that it's written in the book that Mordechai had actually foiled a palace coup by identifying these two guys, Bigtan and Teresh, who had sought to do ill to the king. And the king asks, what did we do to repay him, to reward him for this wonderful act of intervention? And the servants say to the king, we didn't do anything. And the king says, who's at the palace gate? You wouldn't really expect to find anyone at the palace gate. It's the middle of the night. But who's at the gate? And now the Megillah reminds us that what we had seen before is that, Haman was so enraged at the sense that Mordechai wasn't bowing to him, he was going to kill Mordechai, he was going to kill the whole Jewish people, and he is excited to tell Ahasuerus that he was preparing a gallows to hang Mordechai. So he's rushing to the palace, and just at that moment, this all happens. So he's on his way in. B'chatzer. And the servants say to Haman, to Ahasuerus, know who's at the gate? It's actually Haman. Vayomer Melech Yavo, and Ahasuerus says, bring him in. Vayavo Haman, Vayomer LaMelech. Haman shows up, and the king says to him, Ma lasos b'yisrael shercha melech hapeitz. Not how you doing, why are you here, what's happening, how's your plan going? The king has a question. The question is, what do you do? What's your suggestion? If the king wants to honor someone. Here's an editorial comment by the author of the Megillah, reading the mind, so to speak, of Haman. And Haman says to himself, in the interior monologue, Haman says to himself, who could the king possibly want to honor more than me? So because he thinks the king's talking about him, Haman gives the following answer. If the king wants to honor someone, you know what he should do? Yaviu labush malchus asher lavash ba'amelach. You should bring the royal garments. Vesus asher rav achav alav ha'melach. You should bring the royal horse. Vasher nitan keter lamalchus b'rosho, and place the crown on his head. Some ambiguity there, which we'll come back to. But the garments, the horse, and the crown. Vnason halavush ve'asus al yad ish misarei hamelach apartamim. Place it all in the hands of one of the king's princes. Vilabishu es ha'ish, and that person should then dress the person who's meant to be honored. Asher hamelach havetz bikaro. Virkivu al asus berchov ha'ir ve'karu levanav kach yaseh li'ish asher hamelach havetz bikaro. And then that servant should parade around the awardee on the horse in front of everyone and make a big announcement and say, this is what's done to someone who the king wants to honor. Vayomer hamelach lehaman, and the king says to Haman, maher kachas elavush v'asus kasher dibarta. And it's amazing just to notice the way the pasuk is structured here, right? Because it leaves all the suspense until the end. The king says, oh, great idea, great idea. And Haman is thinking, yeah, it's still about him, right? Great idea. Take exactly what you said. Do X, Y, and Z, just like you said. Take the garments and take the this just as you said. V'asa kein, and do it. L'mordechai Yehudi. Wow. Okay, so that's a big turn of events. Haman wasn't expecting that one, but the king said, honor Mordechai the Jew. Hayoshe Bashar Melech, who's sitting at the palace gate, I'll tell Pel Davar, Mikol Asher Dibarta, don't deviate at all from the plan you just articulated. What's Haman going to do, right? There's no case to plead. He was the one who suggested the idea. The king said, great idea. Now go execute it. So Haman has to go execute it. Vayikach Haman es halavush v'asasus ve'elbeshes Mordechai. Takes all the stuff and he dresses Mordechai, puts him on the horse. Vayikiveu berchov ha'ir, and he parades him through the streets. Vayikra lefanav kach yaseh li'ish asher ha'melech chafetz bikaro, and he makes this big proclamation. This is what the king does when he wishes to honor someone. Vayashav Mordechai el shar ha'melech v'haman yichaf el beiso avel v'chafui rosh. After the big parade, after the big ceremony, Mordechai goes back to his spot at the palace gate, and Haman is now totally turned around. Right, he was so excited about his big idea, but now he's in a state of mourning, and his head is covered. If we have time, I'll share a medrash about what his head was covered with. By Yisaper Haman Lazarus Yishtol Karau. He gets home and he tells his wife and he tells his family, anyone who will listen, everything that happened. Terrible story. Vayomer lo chachama v'zeresh ishto. And you know what they say back? They say, that's a troubling omen. Im mizera yudim Mordechai asher achilos and lepol lefanav lo suchalo ki nafol tipol lefanav. If Mordechai, before whom you have begun to fall, if Mordechai is from Jewish stock, you're not going to be able to win. And it's going to be over. Odam medabrim. And they don't even have time to like debrief or talk more about what's happened because it's time for the next scene. It's time for the second party, and the servants rush Haman off to the second party. Okay. There's so much here, there's so much to talk about and so much to unpack. I want to pose four questions that I hope will animate our discussion. Okay, the first question, which I alluded to already, is the meta question. And that is, why is this chapter necessary? It basically, on its face, adds nothing to the narrative. And the litmus test is, what if you just pulled it out? You just omitted chapter 6 from the Megillah. Instead of 10 chapters, there'd be 9, and you'd go straight from 5 to 7, party number 1, party number 2, and there's just no sleepless night in between. Would the story be any different? Would Haman be different? Would Mordechai be different? Would Ahasuerus, like, what would change if we didn't have this chapter? Okay, so I think that's provocative way to measure the importance or the relevance of this entire chapter. Okay, question number one, that's the meta question. Question number two, why exactly is the king sleepless And there's a hint in the pasuk, it's Balaila Hahu, on that specific night. So did something happen recently? Did something happen a long time ago? Is this a coincidence? The story of the Megillah is filled with coincidences. What is the reason or the story behind the sleeplessness of the king, which generates the whole chapter? Question number three. The story reminds us a lot of another episode in Tanakh. Right? There's someone else who gets promoted to become a viceroy, second in command to the king, sort of unexpectedly. He's dressed in royal garb. He's paraded through the streets. There's a big announcement. And of course, that's the story of Yosef. And we'll look at it more in a minute. But it's quite obvious, and it's quite intentional. It's almost impossible to miss. And if you just zoom out for a second, right, we're a little more diffuse, because in the last 2,000 years, the Jewish canon has grown. It's not just Tanakh, but it's Mishnah and Talmud and Rishonim and Achronim, right? So it's harder to spot, right? In 2024, what might be a reference to, you know, something earlier. But if you're writing the Megillah and the only canonical texts are Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim, so any resonance that you're going to have with an earlier text is going to jump out at the reader, because that's the only orbit of text that we're talking about. So if the author of the Megillah is making all of these not even so subtle connections to the character and the story of Yosef, so we have to wonder why that is and what the author of the Megillah might be trying to suggest by making those connections. The fourth and final question that I want to pose is from Haman's perspective. In Haman's own mind, right? Again, he thinks he's talking about himself. So the king says, I want a suggestion. What can we do to honor someone who needs to be honored? And Haman says, that must be me. And what I'd really like, right, what Haman says in so many words is what would really be great for me is if somebody would dress me up in the royal garments and parade me around the streets of Shushan. Why does Haman want that? What is that about? What does that mean? And remember, Haman has it all, right? By order of royal decree, everyone in Shushan has to bow down to Haman. It's not as if, he doesn't have the fame, so he wants to be famous. He's already famous, right? Contemporary equivalent would be to say he's like the vice president, but he could be an American citizen and not really like care too much or know too much about the vice president. But in Shushan, you're second to the king. That's a big deal. Everybody knows Haman. Why does he need to be paraded around the street? And you see how long it goes. Like it's a nothing thing. It's a once around the block kind of thing. And then, right, it's not like there's big parties in Shushan, right? Like a 70-day drink. It's not a 70-day drinking party. It's a pony ride. So why does Haman need a pony ride? Question number one, the big question. Why is the whole chapter necessary? Question number two, why is the king unable to sleep? Question number three, why all the resonances with Yosef in the story? And question number four, why does Haman need to be paraded around Shushan on a horse? Okay, so let me just pause here and ask if there are any questions, comments, or if anybody wants to venture an answer to any of the questions that we have posed. Yeah, Vicky, go ahead. You're muted. Oh, I'm sorry. Still muted.
Right?
Perfect.
Okay. I think he's looking for a knighthood.
Haman is looking for a knighthood.
It's more than just the one pony ride. It's something that can be passed down to the generations. He's looking for a knighthood.
I see. He's saying he doesn't have like some
Not pony
official
riding.
status, and this will somehow give him
He
more
has an
official
official
status.
job, but I think he's looking for something that's generational.
Okay. Fascinating. Fascinating theory. Great. Any other thoughts or questions or comments? Okay. So I want to share with you a couple of sources from the Gemara to kind of get our juices flowing, and think a little bit more about the backstory that could help us explain what's happening at this level of the text, right? Because everywhere, and this is sort of the genesis for the title of the class, the Megillah has two faces. There's always the surface level, and then everything that's happening bubbling beneath the surface. So if you look, and I'll just put it up on the screen at source number one, the Gemara in Megillah actually has like a verse by verse exegesis of this whole chapter. We'll just look at a couple of excerpts from this Gemara. So the Gemara says, "Naflale milsa b'dayte, Amar mai dekaman dezamante Esther lahaman." So the Gemara says we can get into the head of Ahasuerus as he's lying awake at night. There's a thought that keeps going through his head, and it's a question. Mai dekaman dezamante Esther lahaman. You know, Esther is the queen. Ahasuerus is the king. Esther has revealed to Ahasuerus that she has something very important that she wants to ask him about. She's defied convention and taken her life into her own hands. She hadn't been called in 30 days, and she is not entitled to an audience with the king. She proposes an audience with the king. She gets an audience with the king. And Ahasuerus has expressed his magnanimity at Chatzi HaMalchus V'Siyas, and he keeps wondering, like, what is Haman doing at the party? Why, you know, Esther's my queen, I'm the king. She has something she wants, so just say it. And if you want to have it over a cup of wine, happy to. That's what we do. And it should be the two of us. Why is Esther inviting Haman, not just to the first party, now to the second party? Can't understand. So he says, right, and he's ruminating. And if you don't know the answer to the question, you start to come up with theories. So he starts to theorize. Dilma eitza kashakle ilave, dahu gavra lemiktile. So he says, you know, maybe there's another palace coup. Maybe they're conspiring. He speaks in third person to kill that man. Maybe they're conspiring to kill me. You know, you could say he's paranoid, but he's not that paranoid if it just happened to him. Right, it's a couple chapters ago. There was an actual palace coup that was foiled, but there were people in the palace who wanted to kill the king. Read Shakespeare, happens all the time. So that's not even the most paranoid delusion. That's a pretty reasonable, fair thought. So he then continues. Right, in the mind of the Gemara, we're in the mind of Ahasuerus now. So this is where his theory leads him. Hadar Amar. So the next part of his internal logic is this. It says, Ihachi, if that's the case, lo hava gavre derachim li dehave modali. He says, you know, last time this happened, somebody stepped up and told me about it. So if this is a real thing and there's a palace coup brewing, why hasn't anyone come forward to tell me? Dilma ika inish de avid be tevusa. Velo pirate. So I have to answer that question. So he has a new theory. So he says, maybe no one's come forward to inform me about the brewing palace coup because the last time somebody did something on my behalf, I failed to reward them. Mishum hachi mimane inesh velo megalule. Velo megaluli. That's why no one's coming forward. They kind of know, like, there's nothing in it for me if I inform. Miyad vayomer lahavi sefer zichronos divrehem. And so the Gemara says, ah, now we understand why the sleepless king would have asked for the royal chronicles. Of all the books that he could have asked for, of all the questions that he could have asked, right? So the Gemara fills it in, and now it all flows kind of logically. The king is nervous that Haman and Esther are conspiring against him. He doesn't know why no one's come forward to tell him about it. So he reasons the only explanation must be no one's come forward because the last time somebody came forward, I didn't actually honor them. I didn't actually reward them. So let me write that wrong right now. And I'll kind of broadcast to the world that you do something good for the king, boy, you're going to get a lot of credit. And that will just send the message out. If you know something and there's something to be said, Achashverosh says, you let me know. Now, just to deepen this theory, and this is part of a larger discussion which we won't get into right now, the Gemara also theorizes, and it's really like the most compelling explanation, right? There's an unanswered question from the previous parak, which is Ahasuerus's question, and that is, why did Esther invite Haman to the party? And again, you could play this game and say, what happens if Haman's not there? So there's a private audience. Esther and Ahasuerus have the conversation. He says, what is it? She says, I'll tell you, there's a problem. There's someone who wants to wipe out my nation. Ahasuerus says, who is it? And so the alternate version of the story, instead of pointing to the guy across the table, she says, I'll tell you who it is. It's Haman. And Ahasuerus says, Haman? The guy in the next office, right? You get to the same conclusion. Why does Haman need to be in the room when it happens? So the Megillah has a number of answers to this question, but what I think is the most compelling is in source number two, Megillah, Daf Tesvav Amud Beis, on that same Amud, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha Omer, Asbir Lo Panim, Kideshi Harag Huvahi. You know what Esther's plan was? Esther's plan was, you know, tell Achashverosh that Haman's going to kill the Jewish people. How is he going to react? Favorably, unfavorably? It's a toss-up, 50-50. He's not a particularly predictable guy. So what Esther's actual plan is, I'll wink at Haman from across the table. I'll give Ahasuerus the impression that there's something going on between us. And Ahasuerus, a pretty impulsive guy, he'll kill me, says Esther, and he'll kill Mordechai. He'll kill Mordechai. He'll kill Haman. So in that way, I will have, in fact, given up my life, but I'll have given up my life in the service of the greater cause because Ahasuerus will have killed Haman on suspicion of, adultery, and the Jewish people will be saved. So if you add that to the mix, and Esther was sitting at that first drinking party winking at Haman, well, then, you know, Haman's paranoia is not paranoia. It's actually based both on previous events, because there was a palace coup not that long ago, and present events, because how else could you explain what Haman is doing at the party? And Esther is trying to lead Ahasuerus to the conclusion that there's something going on between Haman and Esther, right, which would then lead Ahasuerus to punish them both. Okay. So Ahasuerus is sleepless because he's nervous, right? There are two things that matter to Ahasuerus in the course of this book. One is his queen, and one is his kingdom, is his life. And in this case, he suspects that either one or both might actually be in jeopardy. Maybe someone is making a play on his life, and maybe Haman is actually making a play for his queen. So if that's the case, then we have a kind of first answer, or an answer to the first question, which will now help us read the rest of the narrative. The next question that I want to open up with you is the question about the resonance between our story and the story of Yosef. Let me share with you a medrash which just highlights how many similarities there are. There are even more, but the authors of the medrash, as I always like to say, are very careful and close readers of the text. So they notice all of the similarities that we're meant to notice as the readers. Source number three, this is a medrash in Esther Rabbah. So this goes back to an earlier part of the Megillah that we haven't even seen or we haven't read together in Perek Gimel, but just follow with me for a moment, if you will. Vayhi ki amram ilav yom vayom. So the Megillah says that the servants of the king spoke to Mordechai on a daily basis because he wasn't bowing down to Haman. Rabbi Yochanan b'shem Rabbi Binyamin bar Rabbi Levi b'nei shel Rachel nisan shaveh u'gdulasan shaveh. So, explicating that verse, Rabbi Yochanan says, "I have a tradition that the children, quote unquote, the children of Rachel, have similar backgrounds, right? They both have miracles that occur to them in equal measure, and they both have rise, let's say, a rise to greatness in equal measure." What are we talking about? So we're talking about Yosef, the actual child of Rachel. And why do we consider Mordechai to be the child of Rachel? Because Mordechai is from the tribe of Mordechai ben Yair, ben Kish, Ish, Ishimini. Right? So Mordechai is from the tribe of Benjamin. Mordechai is from the tribe of Binyamin. So they're relatives. They both come from Rachel. So here it is. The Medrash says, "Look at Yosef and look at Mordechai. Nisan shaveh hadahu dichsi vahiki dabra el Yosef yom yom vekan ksi vahiki yom yom velo shamalihem." You have the same language of a daily dose, right? So the wife of Potiphar tried on a daily basis to seduce Yosef, and the servants of Haman tried on a daily basis to try to persuade Haman to try to persuade Mordechai to bow to Haman. Right, and we know, right, that neither would submit. Point number one: Gdula san shava, their greatness is equal. Hadahu dechsi v'asar paro es tabato me'al yado ve'itenos al yad Yosef ve'albeishes bigdei sheish. So what happened if you go back to the 41st chapter of Bereishis? Paro got very excited about the greatness of Yosef. "Look at this guy. He interprets my dreams. The interpretation is something nobody else is able to come up with." And he promotes him right away to make him the second most powerful person in the land. He takes off his ring. He puts it on on Yosef's hand. He gives it to him. He dresses him in all the royal garments. And what happens to Haman? V'kan ksiv. It happened to Haman, and then it happened to Mordechai in the second half of the story. V'yasar. So first, notice he gets the tabas, right? At the beginning of the story, Achashverosh gave Haman the ring. The end of the story, the ring leaves the finger of Haman and goes to Mordechai, just as Paro had given Yosef the royal signet ring. L'halan ksiv. When it came to Yosef, he was paraded around on the royal chariot, and they called out in front of him, "Avreich." The kan ksiv, almost the same thing. It's a royal parade on a royal horse with royal garments. Somebody calling out from right. It's almost lifted straight out of the text of the Yosef of the Yosef narrative. So that's amazing to notice. And there's so many parallels between the Yosef story and the Mordechai story. And who would have noticed, right, that they're both children of of Rachel fascinating. So now we have to zoom out and ask the following question. The author of the Megillah wants us to be thinking of Yosef when we see the character of Mordechai. So why would the author of the Megillah want us to be thinking of Mordechai? So the most basic level, the simplest explanation, is that the author of the Megillah is kind of hoping and dreaming and fantasizing that, hundreds of years after the story of Yosef, there could be a new Yosef. There could be a leader of the diaspora who could save his people. That's the story of Yosef, right? Basically, miraculous story against all odds. He's a servant. He's a Hebrew slave. He has no standing. And there's a time of great crisis for the Jewish people. There's a famine. If not for some major intervention, everyone's going to die. And along comes Yosef, and he saves the day. The story of a Jew in the diaspora who manages to rise to greatness and use his political influence to save the Jewish people. So, well, it's now, X number of years later, and it's Shushan, and it's kind of the same story, right? The entirety of the Jewish people is in danger. Everyone's life is hanging in the balance. And can there be some Jew who could manage to rise in the political ladder and use his political influence to save the Jewish people? We're kind of hoping, the author of the Megillah says, that our Mordechai could be a biblical Yosef. I think that's all true. I want to add one wrinkle and one nuance to the story, which I think is actually quite important and carries with it an important message. What propels the Yosef story forward? What propels the Yosef story forward at every turn are dreams. There are three sets of dreams in the Yosef story. How does Yosef even get into Egypt in the first place? He gets into Egypt because he has these dreams and he makes the decision, rightly or wrongly, to share his dreams of grandeur with his brothers. And those dreams engender all kinds of enmity and create all kinds of fractiousness in the family, so much so that the brothers end up deciding to sell Yosef into slavery. He ends up in Egypt, first set of dreams. The story continues, and Yosef ends up in an Egyptian dungeon. How does he get out of the Egyptian dungeon? What propels the story forward is that the butler remembers that while they were in the dungeon, he and the baker had dreams. Nobody knew what they meant, but Yosef interpreted the dreams. And so Yosef is called out of the dungeon and dressed in royal clothes and placed before the king. And the story moves forward again on the strength of dreams. And then the third time, Yosef is standing before Paro with the task of interpreting Paro's dreams. And because he successfully interprets the two dreams of Paro, boom, he becomes the Mishnah LeMelech. He becomes the viceroy of the entire land of Egypt. And the story is able to move forward. And Yosef, through his political influence, is able to save his father and his brothers and their families and relocate the entirety of Bnei Yaakov, Bnei Israel, to Goshen, and the story continues. What moves the story forward in the Megillah? In the Megillah, there are no dreams. It's in fact an inversion. It's the opposite. The king, right? Whereas Paro, right, had these dreams, the king doesn't have any dreams because he can't sleep, right? It's a story of sleeplessness, right? The opposite of sleeping and dreaming that actually moves the story forward. What I want to suggest is that in this way, the author of the Megillah is actually leveling a subtle critique, which is to say, in the Yosef story, dreams and their interpretations always come from Hashem, and that's the Shem Shamayim Shagur Befiv. Yosef is always talking about his dreams, but he's also always talking about Hashem. Potiphar notices it, Paro, everyone notices it, because for Yosef, everything is part of a larger divine plan. And Paro says, "Can you interpret my dreams?" Yosef says, "I don't know if I could, but whatever Hashem says." And he says that, right? Little servant, slave, Hebrew slave says that in front of the king, right? It's all up to Hashem. And same with his own dreams. Like, why does he even, share them? What? Because he believes that there's some greater plan, that there's some greater aspiration, that there's some greater destiny. Yosef is always talking about Hashem. Yosef is always talking about the larger plan. And at the end of the story, right, the larger plan is just remember, this is not the destination here. The destination is the promised land. The destination is the land of Israel. That's how the book of Bereishis ends. There's a dream, there's an aspiration, there's a destination. And the author of the Megillah wants us to notice that in the Megillah, there's no dream. And it's a problem, because the Megillah is a beautiful book, and there's a lot to celebrate, and there's a miraculous story of survival. But remember what the Gemara says, why is there no Hallel on Purim? We have Hallel on Hanukkah. Why is there no Hallel? So the most compelling answer that the Gemara suggests is because, with other stories of salvation in Jewish history, so we end up as Avdei Hashem. Think of the story of the redemption from Egypt. But the Gemara says at the end of the Purim story, where are we? Akasi Avdei Achashveroshana. We're still servants of Achashverosh, right? We haven't graduated to the next level. The author of the Megillah wants us to know that survival is necessary but insufficient. And that's the first message that I want to share with you that comes out of this necessary chapter. The goal can't just be, can we get to the next generation? Can we survive? Or in today's parlance, right, Jewish continuity, like that's a goal. That's a goal, but that can't be the goal, right? That's too shallow. There has to be a dream. There has to be something more ambitious. There has to be an aspiration. We have to be working toward the fulfillment of a divine plan for the Jewish people. And if we're not doing that, right, then we're not in the league of Yosef. We're in a different place and we're not where we should be. Message number one. Now I want to come to the last question that we asked, and then we'll circle back to the first question. The last question that we asked is, I put it a little sarcastically, like Haman needs a pony ride. Why does Haman need to be paraded around on a horse on the streets of Shushan? So Haman is a spoof. Haman is a caricature, and that's actually one of the lessons of this chapter. There's a kind of raging debate as to whether or not we should think of Achashverosh as a cunning politician or as kind of a dim-witted guy who's always just being acted upon. And chapter six, or in chapter six, is actually a strong case to be made for the former, that Achashverosh is not a dummy. He's actually a savvy politician. And when he poses the question to Haman and says, "What would you do for someone who wants to be who needs to be honored by the king?" It's a kind of very clever psychological test, right? Haman says, Achashverosh says, "Haman, tell me what would you do?" What? And Haman's answer is so telling. Haman says, "What you should do is you should let the person be paraded around as if they are the king." And Achashverosh thereby learns what's actually going on in the mind of Haman. There's a funny Gemara in Chulin, which it's funny for a lot of reasons. We'll just learn one excerpt from it. The Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, Haman mina Torah minayin. Is there a hint in the Torah anywhere of Haman? And the Gemara says, yeah, there's a hint. Actually, right at the beginning in Bereishis, when the Pasuk says, Hamin ha'etz asher tzivisicha levilti achal mimenu achalta. So you see the words Haman, you see the letters Haman, hey mem nun, from the word Hamin ha'etz, also punctuated differently, but you see the letters hey mem nun, you see the word Haman. There's a hint to Haman. So what's the significance of the fact that there's a hint to the word Haman in a pasuk about the failure of Adam and Chava to heed the warning against eating from the tree of good and evil in the garden? So there's a strong case to be made that what the Gemara wants us to recognize is that Haman suffers from the same failing that Adam and Chava suffered from in that early moment in Gan Eden. What's the failing? The failing is you have everything except one thing. You have everything except one thing, and you just have to have the thing you can't have. So in the garden, any tree you want to eat, it's paradise, it's Gan Eden, anything you want, one thing you can't have. And suddenly, right, that activates this need, this impulse, this desire. Adam and Chava, right, they have to have the one thing they can't have. And that's actually Achashverosh. In the beginning of the story, there's one thing. Everyone bows to Haman except one guy. 99.9%, like, it's a pretty good batting average, right? Like, if some politician in 2024 had an approval rating, like, 333 million Americans are all bowing down, and there's one guy in Michigan. Like, we'd take that approval rating. Haman doesn't accept that approval rating. There's one guy who won't bow down, and it eats him up, and it consumes him, and it enrages him, and he has to have the one thing he can't have. That's point number one. Now we have point number two in our narrative. And this I want to propose is the answer to our question. What's the one thing that Haman can't have? The one thing Haman can't have is the kingship. Everyone else bows. Everyone else, he's second in command, second most important person in the whole region, 127. Everyone bows down. Everyone respects everything he's supposed to do. But there's one guy who's above him. And it eats him up. And so, what does he do? He wants to have the one thing that he can't have. And again, it's a caricature. It's like, for whom would this actually be meaningful? To play, like, dress up when you're the viceroy of the whole country? Really? Like, kindergarten, first grade, like at some point you outgrow the need to dress up and pretend to be someone you're not. But this is the spoof. For Haman, that's like, wow, if I could just be king for you're not king. You're who you are. You're just on a horse and someone is walking around with you. But he needs to be the king. Because it's the one thing he's not. I'll just share with you kind of amazing observation by Rashi. If you go back to the text, so there are actually three things that that Haman said you should do. What should you do? You should get the royal clothes, the levush. You should get the sus. You should get the royal horse, and you should get the Keter Malchus, and you should get the crown. And then when Achashverosh says to do it, it's not there. There's no crown. There's only the horse and the there's only the horse and the clothes. There's a few artistic depictions of this chapter over the years, and I just picked one for you. that's actually faithful to the text. In some of them, Mordechai is being paraded around with the crown. But if you read the text carefully, no crown. Okay, so this one, the artist was a careful reader of the text. There's no crown. There's the royal garments, there's the royal horse, but no keter. So what does Rashi say? What happened to the keter? Didn't Haman suggest it? So he says, "V'nasana levush basus al yad ish." Where did it go? Bes hakeser lo hizkir. When we actually got to executing the plan, it didn't come up. Shera eino shamelch ra'al sha'amar sheitno hakeser barosh adam. So Rashi interprets based on the Gemara. He says when Haman said the word keter, he noticed that Achashverosh didn't take too well to the notion that the king's crown should be placed on someone who was not the king. So Haman like quickly dropped it when the plan actually came to fruition. But that Rashi makes the scene even more stunning because if in fact Haman was able to discern that Achashverosh objected to his wearing the crown, why did he persist with the rest of the plan? There's such a deep message here, not just about power, the abuse of power, and the corruption of power, but there's something even more tangible for, us regular people who are not in positions of, major authority. And that's this sense that this narcissistic, bent and the need to be the center of attention and the need to have the one thing you can't have, that's very close by and that's very pernicious and very dangerous. Chapter 6 is a cautionary tale. Look what happens when a person is categorically unable to see the world through anyone else's eyes but their own. Anyone looking at this scene, right, and you get it kind of at the end of the story, even Haman's wife, even his advisors, even his family, right, to any objective onlooker, it's so obvious what's happening here. But when you're so consumed with the need to advance your own agenda, like Haman is, he's totally blinded to what is directly in front of him. And it's here, with all of this in mind, that I want to return to our first question, the meta question: why is chapter 6 necessary at all? And here I actually want to make a point about theology. Emunah is a big deal, and it's a big leap. So I know I'm supposed to believe. I know I'm supposed to have faith, and I want to have faith. But you know what the truth is? The truth is that it's hard. It's hard to have emunah, and there's a lot of reason to be skeptical, and there's a lot of reasons to be doubtful, because there's real evil in the world. Haman is a real thing. B'chol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu. There's a Haman in every generation, and wow, October 7th, in case we forgot, there's a face of evil. There's a face of Amalek, and here it is. Like, who could have imagined in 2023? October 7th, that such a thing could actually happen, and it happened. And it sows the seeds of doubt and skepticism, and where is Hashem, and where is the promise of never again? And very hard to be optimistic, and very hard to be faithful on October 8th. So when I read the denouement of the Purim story, do I really believe that could happen in my lifetime? This is a story from thousands of years ago. I'm reading the Megillah in 2024. 1 minute ago, Haman was ready to commit genocide. And the next minute, he's being hanged. And what's my reaction? Do I say, yeah, okay, that's a real thing that happens, and maybe that'll happen in 2024 also? Or do I say, I'm not so sure. That sounds like a good tale for kids, and that sounds like miracles of another time, and have a hard time making the jump from McGillis Esther to 2024 because I just witnessed October 7th. So the author of the Megillah says, you know what? I know you're going to read this text in a future time. And I know that the text is going to sound too miraculous to believe. It's going to sound like, that happened a long time ago. That can happen in my time. It's going to be hard to assimilate that message. So along comes Perek Vav. It's such a kind of meaningless non-event. The king, sleeplessness, and his record books, and parading somebody around on the royal horse. Someone's going to play dress up for a day. But it's actually a brilliant literary trick. Because chapter six is very easy for us to read. Like, yeah, that could happen. That's kind of a funny reversal of fortune story, and the stakes weren't that high. Haman came in, and he didn't know what was going to happen, and he thought it was going to be him who was on the horse that morning, and ended up being Mordechai on the horse that morning. That could happen. But if that reversal of fortune story could happen on a micro level, if Haman could end up parading Mordechai around Shushan on the royal horse, then it becomes a little easier to accept that something like this could happen on the macro level. It's a brilliant, if subtle, technique that happens on a literary level to make a theological or even psychological point. Namely, if faith is an uphill battle, let's take it one step at a time. If I didn't have chapter six, if I just jumped from chapter five to chapter seven, there's a party. Esther does the courageous thing. She has an audience with Ahasuerus. Mihuzev Ezehu, she points to Haman, and boom, 2 seconds later, Haman makes the decision with a little help from Charvona, off with his head. He has to be hanged on the gallows. If we just had chapter five, we just had chapter seven, we wouldn't have, as readers, we wouldn't have any time to assimilate the sense that that message, that possibility is actually real, like that could actually happen. But this is the significance, and this is the value of foreshadow. It's like, oh, I have an inkling something like this happened on a smaller scale. I've seen this before. That happens. And so when it happens for real, or when it happens on a larger scale, it's not shocking to me anymore. Like, oh no, that happens. There's reversals of fortune. Sometimes that actually does happen. And if it could happen on a small scale, it could happen on a large scale. And so you get to the end of the Megillah, and the process of developing emunah is that much stronger because we have a path to get from here to there, and the path is Perek Vav of the Megillah. And so I humbly leave you with these three all too relevant messages for our lives in 2024. Message number one, continuity is not sufficient. We need to dream of the grander Jewish story the way that Yosef always kept dreaming. Message number two, as one of my favorite bumper stickers says, only you can prevent narcissism. There's something quite damning, and there's something quite pernicious about a worldview that prevents a person from seeing the perspectives of other people. And it's so pernicious and so problematic that if you fall into the trap, the Megillah says, you could actually create a Haman. And message number three, if faith is hard, and faith is hard, if faith is hard, try to build it in bite-sized pieces. Don't jump from chapter five to chapter seven. Read chapter six. Assimilate the sense that reversal of fortune can happen on a small scale. And then it'll be possible to absorb the message that the reversal of fortune can happen on a large scale. That's our hope. That's our bracha. That's our tefillah for this time and for all times. The season of Purim to Pesach is always called by Chazal Zman Geulatenu. It is the season of our redemption. It's our hope. It's our tefillah. The same way that Keheref Ayin, sometimes just out of nowhere, in the blink of an eye, we can have a Yeshua and experience a redemption. Same way that we saw it in the Purim story, may Hashem bring a Yeshua and a redemption to this time in Jewish history as well. I'm going to stop here, but happy to stay on and take any questions or comments.
I loved what you said. Do you think